Okay, so we'll be talking about the USDA food program, and I'm going to be presenting very briefly an analysis of the composition of the USDA foods that are offered to the states and the selections that they have made from these packets. The study was done as a part of a larger evaluation that addressed five food programs, the CSEFP, the CSFP, NSLP, FDPIR, and the TFAP. So I'm just focusing on the NSLP in the interest of time and to hit the high points. The National School Lunch Program is administered by the Food and Nutrition Services of the United States Department of Agriculture. And the way it works is that each of the collaborating states receives food as well as finances to implement this program. The states then have contracts that are established with the school food service authorities at the district level. And USDA provides both food, USDA foods or commodity foods as they were called before, as well as financial support to implement these programs. The USDA actually makes these food purchases from agriculture surpluses that are available. They also go ahead and buy additional food products so that they can make these available to the system. These include both perishable as well as non-perishable foods, and depending on what is available, schools are provided with a certain entitlement funding that they can use to make purchases from a list of foods. The list of foods that are available for the school lunch program has as many as 200 different food items. And the schools can choose what they want, filter this information up to their states, the state consolidates it, looks at their entitlement funds, and then says, okay, this is what we have available, this is what the list has, let's reconcile and see what we can buy. So they can choose any of the products that are offered and exclude some of the foods that are provided. Bonus foods are available to schools in addition to these entitlement funds, and these are made available when they are available on a fair share basis. A prior 2010 study that was done by the ERS indicated that USDA foods make up about 15% to 20% of the products that are served in the school lunch on any given day. So they are not adequate enough to provide the one-third requirements. And that's because the USDA also provides financial support to make up the difference, and schools can make the purchases using the money that they're provided. I'm not savvy at this, so bear with me. Okay, so the objectives of this particular research were to develop a very comprehensive database for all of the USDA foods for the five programs that I talked about, and then to look at the quantities of foods that are offered for each one of these programs and what states are actually selecting from there, and then compare the nutrient as well as the food group comparisons to the dietary standards that are established. The way we did this is a five-step process. We first looked at all of the foods that are offered in the lunch program as well as the others, developed a very comprehensive database with every single food item, including the frozen variety, the fresh variety, the canned variety of any given product, and then used some weights of the foods that are offered, applied nutrients using the FNDDS database, and then compared it to the dietary standards. For the NSLP, there were a list of foods that were offered in 2009. This included over 200 food items. We also looked at the entitlement and the bonus detail status reports that are provided to us by the USDA. And in addition to that, there are fresh fruits and vegetables that are offered through the DOD program. So we included all of these as a part of the USDA food package. To estimate the weight of the USDA foods offered per participant, we had to take the denominator, which is the number of children who participate in the program. We had to take into account the number of foods that the distribution was in at the school, which was 180 days of school that is required. We also have to stress that to compute the average foods as offered was a bit tricky, because when states are selecting it, we know the participation rate and we know what they're buying, and it's very easy. But when you think about an as offered package, it's almost hypothetical, so to speak, because to try and figure out this is what they can choose, how much should we allocate to their purchases, we actually made a very good determination based on pricing and said, okay, this is the entitlement funding, let's distribute it equally for all of the food groups that are offered, and within each food group then, whatever the allocation is, allocate it equally to all of the items within that food group. So the as-offered package is a very hypothetical package. We applied nutrients. As I said, we used the FNDDS. We also took into account some of the wastage that would happen, because there is a lot of waste in food prep, so we deducted 5% of the weight of each food item to calculate the nutrients and the contribution towards the USDA food packages. The CFND is actually the USDA commodity food and nutrient database that we created. We compared it to various dietary standards, and for any given program, there are a range of ages that are participating in the program. So again, this is a very hypothetical situation where we had to account for the age distribution of the children in the program. And so we developed an average nutrient and food group target for a reference participant, which was based on the mix of age and gender for any given group that you have. So you might have 8 and 9 year olds, 11 to 13 year olds. Within any of those age groups, we looked at the distribution in Senda 3 and assigned the weights, and then based on the proportion that we had in each one of the food groups, in each of the age groups, we calculated the reference requirements for these participants. The highest nutrient requirements for any age and gender group was used for that particular age, and then we are providing a reference intake. We compared it to 4 dietary standards, the DRIs, the Thrifty Food Plans, the USDA Food Patterns, and the HEI, which helps us to understand what the government is providing. I'm going to be sharing with you the DRIs and the food pattern requirements or comparisons. So in 2009, USDA made available 1,308 million pounds of foods through these food distribution programs, and this translates on average to about 58 grams per child per day as offered. When you think about what was delivered, you can see that more food was delivered, which is 108 grams. And you can think about why are they delivering more than they can offer. And the reason for that is that when we were computing the as offered package, I indicated it was a hypothetical assumption where we assume that they can pick an equal volume of all of the foods that are offered to finish their entitlement funds. When states are choosing their foods, they don't have to pick everything that is offered, and what they are buying are the products that are usually more expensive to buy on the market. And so they are buying it at a cheaper price, and those are heavier and they weigh more than what you would have otherwise. When you're looking at the combination of the entitlement and bonus foods, you can see that the as-offered package includes a lot of different colors representing different food groups, and it's a very healthy package, including meat, grains, whole grains, milk, juice, cheese, as well as vegetables. But when you look at the entitlement and the bonus package that were delivered, you can see that the proportions are no longer similar to what was offered. States are buying a lot of milk, vegetables, cheese, and fruit. Those are the 4 food groups that they're buying in. A prior study that was done in California actually showed that about 82% of the purchases that are made are in the milk and in the meat and the cheese category. So there are some changes where they are buying more fruits and vegetables, probably because of the changes in requirements to the school food guidelines. When we look at the comparison to the USDA food amounts, we can see that the as-offered package typically does not offer more than 10% of the food pattern requirements. The as-delivered does a little bit better with most of the food groups, except for the total grains, where you can see that the as-offered package has about 10% of the requirements of the USDA food patterns that are being met compared to the as-delivered. And what's more interesting is that the as-offered package includes an equal proportion of whole as well as refined grains, but the as-delivered package representing state preferences shows that most of the product purchased are refined products. The other interesting thing is that there's a lot of protein foods, particularly meat, poultry, and egg, that is being delivered compared to what is being offered. And so protein foods are making up a lot of the purchases that are being made by the states. The SOFAs, the solid fats, alcohol, which is not a part of this, but it's a formula, and the sugars, the added sugars, are a part of the final calculation. And while the as-offered package, because it includes all of the wholesome foods, meets the guidelines of the SOFAs of providing 20% or fewer calories, the as-delivered package exceeds these guidelines. And that's just reflecting the preferences where they are purchasing more proteins as well as oils. So when you energy adjust the packages, the prior slide that I was showing was unadjusted energies. But if you energy adjust the package and say, okay, if this is the package that's being offered, and if you energy adjust to 2,000 calories, what does the composition look like? Well, you can see that the as-delivered package fares a lot better than the as-offered package for a lot of the food groups. For example, 77% of the requirements for the fruit group are being met by the as-delivered package, 96% for the vegetables compared to 25% of the as-offered package. packages. But when you come down to the starchy vegetables, you can see that the as-delivered package gets high marks on the vegetable group, primarily because it's driven by the purchases of starchy vegetables. If you continue going down, you can also see that the total grains in the as-offered package are a lot better, 122%, but as-delivered is 62%, and a lot of it is coming from refined grains, emphasizing what we were seeing in the previous slide. The protein foods, again, that story continues where they're buying a lot of meat, poultry, and egg, and therefore the protein contribution is a lot higher. The dairy is pretty similar in both of them. The oil is higher in the as-offered package because it's pure oil, and we are delivering fewer quantities of oil to the states compared to what is being offered. The same trends in the SOFAs is noted here, where the offered package meets the guidelines, whereas the delivered package actually exceeds the SOFAs guidelines. So when you look at the per calorie contribution of various food food items that are being selected, you can see that the as offered package assumes an equal representation and is different than the as delivered packages. And the differences are in the context of these specific food items, and I don't need to review every single one of them, but brown rice, whole grain pasta, whole wheat flour, canned corn, reduced fat items such as cheddar cheese, milk, dry milk, soybean, these are being picked up in fewer quantities and therefore they are offering fewer calories as well. More of the calories are coming from items such as fresh potatoes, carrots, celery, which are great items to purchase, but they're also purchasing a whole lot of other products such as a lot of peanut butter, again, a great item, and reflecting the composition, which is more protein-oriented, more vegetable-oriented, as well as the starchy combinations in there. And then again, there's a whole lot of chicken, ground beef, turkey. So there is enough variety within the food items that the states are purchasing, and both the as-offered and as-delivered packages are substantially different. So when you try and take a look at the DRIs, the federal mandate is that the school lunch programs were supposed to provide a third of the requirements for selected nutrients. These were calories, proteins, carbohydrates, fats, sat fat, calcium, iron, vitamin A, C, and D. And we just focused our analyses on these specific requirements, and we did two things. We looked at the contribution of the USDA foods towards meeting the DRI for the entire day, as well as towards meeting the one-third requirement for the NSLP. And the numbers in parentheses here are showing what contribution they are making towards the school lunch program. And you can see that, in general, the as-offered package ranges from about 4% of vitamin D requirement meeting per day to as much as 56% of the calories from fat. Again, I'll go back to the fat issue because we shouldn't really be focusing on the contribution of fat from the USDA foods. But the as-delivered package is also pretty much the same, providing about 7% of the daily calorie requirements compared to the 9% from the as-offered package. And what's interesting is that when you look at the contribution towards the lunch program, they do meet a fifth of the requirements of the school lunch program. So calories, 27% of the calories that are supposed to be provided in the national school lunch program do come from the USDA foods, re-emphasizing that USDA foods do provide about 15 to 20%, or in some instances a little bit more, of the requirements. For example, the protein is about 82% of the national school lunch program requirements are coming from the USDA foods. Stepping back a minute on the fat content, USDA foods, as I told you, are not the only source of the NSLP. They are supplemented with additional purchases made by the states. So when you look at the numbers and say USDA foods are providing 56% of the calories from fat, it's okay, because these are the other foods do represent a mix, and hopefully they are healthier than to balance this out. So I'm going to conclude by just saying that there were differences in the as-offered and the as-delivered food packages, and state preferences based on the price that they have available for these products, as well as the selections that are preferred by the districts, are reflecting the key differences between the as-offered and the as-delivered food packages. And essentially, the states are picking up a lot of cheese, fruits, meat, and vegetables, and they are not purchasing a whole lot of whole grains or even regular grains to that extent, oil, milk, and juice. They are also purchasing more starchy vegetables, refined grains, and proteins, and therefore, because of these purchases, the SOFAS content of the as-offered packages is lower than the as-delivered package. Both the as-offered and the as-delivered food packages provide about 10% or fewer calories, calcium, iron, and vitamin A requirements for the day, and they are contributing to about 30% or fewer requirements for the NSLP program. So they do have the potential, and overall they do make a healthy contribution towards the school meals. It's my final slide, and this report can be downloaded from the FNS website. The presenters acknowledge that we have received a lot of support from the USDA towards this, with specific references to people who helped us think about this analysis approach. And so Ed Harper, Dennis Ranalli, and other staff from the FNS offices were very instrumental in working through the methodology to compute the as-offered and as-delivered packages. And as stated before, any opinions expressed here are exclusively ours and not of the FNS. Thank you, guys.
I guess my answer is sort of twofold. I think there are lessons that can be learned from WIC and applied to SNAP, but as you already pointed out, WIC and SNAP are very different programs with very different missions. So not all of the WIC model can be applied to SNAP very easily. Particularly the food packages. The food packages are developed for very particular populations. For low-income pregnant, breastfeeding, postpartum women, for young children, for infants, for very specific life course models for specific ages and health, essentially. Whereas when you're trying to apply something like that to a SNAP model, that's a lot more difficult because you have such a diverse range of people that are in the SNAP program, full range of ages, full range of genders, full range of health issues. So that might not necessarily translate as easily, but from the WIC learning perspective, we do know that when we have improved the availability of fruits and vegetables and other healthy foods with the revisions of the WIC food package, we have seen increased consumption of those healthy foods. So I'm not really at a place where I've thought very, very specifically about all of the minutiae of what to apply to WIC or to SNAP from WIC. But I do think there are opportunities for learning from WIC, because we did see with the revisions of the WIC food package that it improved access to healthy food, it improved in low-income neighborhoods, it improved consumption of fruits and vegetables. But it's also very difficult from the perspective that SNAP is it's essentially money, so it's more equivalent to our fruit and vegetable vouchers, so maybe there's some learning that some of SNAP can be specifically for fruit and vegetables or something like this. This is not the opinion of the National WIC Association. This is just me thinking off the top of my head as a public health professional. But with WIC, it's very specific food items that are redeemed. So that translation is also sort of difficult. So I'm sure we'll all be having this discussion in the coming years, so I look forward to it, but I'm sorry I couldn't be more direct of, like, this is my opinion, this is, you know, that and the other.
From a participant perspective, the particular participants, so the people who are receiving WIC and SNAP, and they talked about SNAP being easier to use, and when you restrict food choice, it makes it a barrier to being on WIC. And so my thought is that more people need to be in WIC. So if this is a barrier to even using this program that does work, it's awesome, but you might see participant leakage from the SNAP program, and why you wouldn't want to restrict usage if you're going to see participant leakage. So just a perspective from the participants themselves and what they directly said.
But I think that there's a tremendous amount of work going around that questions from WIC about the new food package. And one of those has to do with tightening up the vendor requirements. And I know, Martel, if you could speak to this, because, you know, they, especially for small stores, independent markets, when the new food package for WIC came out, it tightened up and said it had, you know, stocking requirements. And that was a huge change for small markets. And I think what's important right now is that USDA, I guess the deadline is this week, but they put out something at the end of August for the last 2 months for us to all comment on about strengthening the vendor requirements for SNAP. So maybe you could speak about that, Martel, because we found some really interesting things with WIC.
Sure. So there are actually a few published papers out that are highlighting that the improved stocking requirements in WIC approved stores has improved access to, well, it's sort of obvious, but there's peer-reviewed literature on it now. it's improved access in communities that didn't have access to fresh fruit and vegetables before, that were essentially more of your food desert type areas. And one city in particular highlights that actually the community views it as a positive, like, thing in their community, and they've noticed essentially. So by doing that, we now have fruits and vegetables in areas that were not in areas in before. So I think what Lorelei was trying to convey is that potential opportunity with SNAP stocking requirements could present an opportunity for access to healthier foods. Without restricting use of SNAP, essentially. And maybe this is not as obvious, but essentially the WIC, because of the WIC food package, having those fruit and vegetable vouchers, the stores are guaranteed a specific amount of use, so there's less risk involved in having those fruits and vegetables at that store, whereas before they might have been more hesitant to have them because they were perishable, but they want to be a WIC vendor because the WIC vendor ends up spending additional money in addition to their fruit and vegetable vouchers and their WIC checks at the store. I don't remember the exact sort of multiplier, but I want to say it's in, if I'm remembering correctly, and you can send me an email if you're really interested, but I think it's for every dollar that a family spends in with their WIC checks, they'll sort of multiply that by four times with their overall grocery bill. So it's, you know, it's the vendors want to be on the program, so they've stocked fruits and vegetables and other healthy foods.
Okay, you can have one more question, and then you can ask. Farrell Burton,
Gretchen Swanson Center for Nutrition. My dissertation that I recently finished was also on WIC, looking at participants' barriers and attitudes in Arizona. And I wanted to concur with you that a lot of the barriers had to do with stigma and bias at the point of sale. And a question for you guys. Some of my participants brought up how social media is contributing to barriers. There are images on social media that such as like from some e-cars that is saying, you know, must be nice to be able to have a smartphone and be on these different government programs. And my question for you is, how can we as public health professionals look at negating some of these larger messages that are being disseminated on places like Facebook to improve the overall image of WIC and thereby hopefully reduce some of these stigma barriers?
That didn't come up in our data, but that's terrible, and I've seen it. I've seen that, like, if you just read the comment section on some of the, like, things that come up in the news, it's just gross. But in terms of how to address it, and solutions came from our participants of just creating this public education campaign of, like, letting people know in the community how this helps, whether it's SNAP or WIC. These are dollars that are contributing to the community. If participants are spending their WIC vouchers or their SNAP dollars at the grocery store, those are dollars that are staying in the community. It helps that vendor. It helps everyone at large, is keeping kids in the community healthy. So really just making it known, expanding the knowledge of not, it just doesn't keep people healthy, but it's really boosting the economy. If we take this out of the economy, if we kick people off or stigmatize this even more, like, do an experiment. Let's see what happens. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be really terrible. It's going to look bad. So maybe just creating a public education campaign about what's going to happen. All right. Time's up.
Okay.